Accession number 23442, Reel 1.
Jim Norton, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Birmingham on the 11th of July 1919.
Okay. Did you grow up and have your schooling in Birmingham?
Yes, I was one of a big family. I was one of 10. And I went to various schools in Birmingham until the age of 14, which was the leaving age at the time. And then I had to get out and earn a living to help the family.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a shipping clerk on for the railway.
And what was your address in Birmingham?
The address was originally in Edgbaston, and most of the time, early time, was in Edgbaston area.
Which school did you go to?
I went to a church school originally, then later on we moved out of the centre of town to a place called Stechford, and I went to a school called Beaton Road School in Yardley, and was there until I was 14.
What kind of work did you get on leaving school?
When I left school, you'll appreciate that this was in 1933. It was difficult times, and I got a job with the Birmingham Cooperative Society as a baker's van boy, and I did that initially for 3 years. And at the age of 17, then you either were kept on, but something like 70% were lost the jobs at 17. I was kept on, worked inside for a year on relief work, and eventually at the age of 19, I got my own journey. Now, I got the full rate of pay, and I was on a lucrative round, and I was doing very nicely financially at that time, to the extent that I was able to have my own car before I was 20. However, I realised that having got that far, where did I go from there? And there really, a promotion from that job would have been a reduction in salary, because I would have lost all my commission. And so I decided that I had to improve my education. So I started a correspondence course, general education, in order to get what at that time was matriculation, but that's the A level and university entrance level. I'd been doing that for about a year when I was called up. I did try to continue it when I was called up, but of course it wasn't practical. So that finished at that time.
What was life like in Birmingham for a person like yourself pre-war?
Well, times were hard. Certainly with a big family, and our weekly treat was for Sunday tea was some jam on the bread and margarine. I didn't go hungry, but things were difficult. But having said that, it was a happy family, and we enjoyed life. But there wasn't very much money about.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did. It was Sunday morning. We stood round the radio in the living room. It was one of these terraced houses, and heard the announcement. I was 20 at the time, and at 20 you had to register for the militia. and I had registered for the militia 3 or 4 months earlier. And when that was declared, in my ignorance, I said, well, I have to go. Where do I go? Thinking that I was registered and I'd got to go. And, of course, then I was eventually called up in October at the age of 20 and went to Norton Barracks at Worcester for my initial training.
How did you feel about the news that war had been declared?
Well, I felt it was inevitable. I had a prickly feeling, obviously, up the back, but there just wasn't any question of what am I going to do. I had to go into the forces. When I say had to, it wasn't unwillingly, but it was a duty, and that was just accepted at the time.
Did you feel patriotic?
Yes, we certainly did, because I'd listened to the way things were building up with Hitler and the invasion of Poland and all that build-up, and it was obvious that he had to be stopped. And if he wasn't stopped, then all our values and our type of living could be altered forever.
What happened when you went to Norton Barracks?
Well, I was called up and I did my initial 8 weeks infantry training. And then I was selected to go on a signal training course at Norton Barracks for an extra 3 months. So my training period took a total of 5 months.
Can you describe each type of training in turn, please?
Well, the initial training was drill, mainly drill initially, because they won't let you out of the barracks until you look and walk like a soldier. You have to pass out before you can go out. Weapon. All the weapons and the field work, generally how to handle yourself and look after yourself. That was the initial 8 weeks.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
Generally very good. You had to put up with you were going to be bawled at all the time, and but it's a way of life and you don't bother about it too much. I didn't come across any bullying as such, but it possibly happened on occasions.
And the signals training?
The signals training was very intensive, and we were taught to lay cables, telephone lines, operate switchboard and telephones. Morse code, and believe it or not, the old semaphore flags, and there wasn't too much radio at the time, but we learned the fundamentals, and I enjoyed that very much. But when that finished, that took us through to about April, May. Before Dunkirk, well, a couple of months before Dunkirk. But at the end of that time, I was put on a draft to go to France with a BEF. But I used to play football, and I was playing in goal for the depot. And we were practicing on a drill shed. A drill shed is just a covered area on concrete. And one of the PTIs was the Wolverhampton and England centre forward, Dennis Westcott. And we were playing there, and we both went up for a ball. I was green. I played no professional football, but he knocked me down. And I damaged the cartilage. So instead of going undraft, I had to go into hospital and have a cartilage removed. And then by the time that was completed and I was fit again, they were just coming back from Dunkirk. So although I cursed him at the time, he could well have saved my life.
What are your next memories?
Well, from then on, it was, again, training. The depot at Worcester was about 3 miles from Worcester Centre. And they wanted to keep a watch on the enemy planes, which used to come up through Bristol, up to the Severn to Worcester, and then turn off for Coventry or Birmingham. And so they set up a platoon, which they call the Guards Platoon. And for 6 months we did regular guards, they were spit and polish guards, but it was one signaller and one infantryman. And we had a post on top of the cathedral and a post on top of the keep at the barracks, where we kept communication by with lamps. And we reported all the aerial activity going over. It was a bit unfortunate in some ways because my family was in Birmingham. We could see the bombing of Birmingham and Coventry very clearly. And I used to think, well, here I am fighting the war, and I'm here quite safe, and my family are being pummeled to hell in Birmingham. Having said that, it was an enjoyable time because we didn't do much else other than spit and polish and a guard every 3 or 4 days. And I was able to get home to Birmingham very frequently. And the guard itself was quite relaxed up on the top of the tower, and we couldn't carry a rifle, and we couldn't use ammo boots. We had to use plimsolls to go through the cathedral, and so it was a very, once you were on guard, it was a very relaxed sort of guard.
Why did you have to use plimsolls?
Pardon?
Why did you have to use plimsolls?
Because of the noise. You know, we had to go through, perhaps when there was a service on, the guard was changed every 2 hours. But it was very nice and pleasant.
How did your family fare under the air raids?
Well, they were all fortunate. They spent a lot of time in the Anderson shelters. Indeed, so did I when I was home on leave, which was very frequent from Worcester because I had a car, and I used to get home. I wasn't away from home very long, let me say that, and get home for a few hours and occasionally overnight.
Any bombs on Worcester?
Yeah, the odd one, but nothing serious. Nothing serious. There were a few bombs dropped, but we were out of it. It was quite peaceful, really.
Where did the bombs drop on Worcester?
There was one near the hospital, which is in the centre of town, and there was another one dropped on one of the outskirts, but it was. We figured that it wasn't an attack. It was planes getting rid of the bombs on the way back.
What happened to you next?
Well, in December of 1940, the 11th Battalion had been established in Hereford in June 1940. These were mainly fellows who were aged 31, 32, called up, family men. They trained on the race course in Hereford, and they had little or no equipment. They learnt the drill and the arms drill with broomsticks, and that was so for months. That's all they had. They had didn't all have full uniform. Well, then they were transferred out to Great Yarmouth, and they didn't have any trained signallers. So 10 of us who were at Worcester on this guard were posted to the 11th Battalion. And we didn't stay there long. We moved back into the Midlands within 6 days. I was only at Yarmouth for about 6 days. We were still short of equipment. We started getting equipment through, but for example, the signal platoon, we were teaching Morse code because there was just a nucleus of 10 of us who were trained. There was a couple of others trained, and we had to get a platoon trained. And I was a private at the time, so I wasn't involved so much in the training, but it did fall on us to bring the others along a bit. And the only equipment we had was we had a lamp stand, a three-legged stand that you put the lamp on to signal for coding. But we didn't have a lamp, and we had a bicycle lamp tied to it. We had to learn Morse code and signalling with equipment like that. We were issued with rifles. We from Worcester already had rifles, but the main battalion were issued with rifles. But they went something like 6 months without a rifle. And we continued training in the Midlands until 40, about 41. When we were transferred to the Guards Division, the Guards Armoured Division. We were the only infantry company in the Guards Armoured. All the others were guards, and we were told that we were chosen for the job. And we joined the Guards Armoured Division, and equipment came through so thick and fast that we couldn't cope with it. Within a matter of a month or 6 weeks of being in the Guards Division, we were fully equipped.
This is still the 11th Worcesters?
Pardon? That's the 11th Worcesters, yes. And so we stayed with the Guards Armoured Division for about 2 years, and then we were transferred to when the 43rd Division was a battalion short. We were transferred over to the 43rd Division. But then in between, our 1st Battalion, which was out in Tobruk, was badly mauled. They were going to reform, but it was decided not to reform them. They brought a cadre of about 15 people back to the UK, and the 11th Battalion was reformed as the 1st Battalion.
Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were with the Guards Armoured?
One that stands out is that the Guards Armoured Division used to hold the sports at Wembley, and it was a great thrill running around the track at Wembley. It was mainly service people, but 25,000 spectators, and that was something that stands out. The Guards Armoured Division, we used to go to Wales for a month's training under canvas every year. We generally were very happy within the Guards Armoured Division, and getting equipment and stock was not a problem.
What was this equipment that poured in?
Well, first of all, it was personal equipment. But then it was specialist equipment, like signals, for instance. We then had radio sets, and we had one switchboard, but we were equipped right up to full standard with all the equipment. And we had a carrier platoon, and all those other specialist platoons got all their equipment. The other thing is, because it was a motorised division, we had a lot of transport, and at that time there weren't many people, weren't too many people who could drive, and so in the army you had to have a 2-week MT course before you could drive. But we were suddenly, signal platoon suddenly received delivery of a Hillman Minx, and we were due to go out and exercise with it the following day. So I was told I got to take a driving test, and they bought a big six-wheeler, and they took me down the road, and I reversed into a field and back. They said, right, here's your license. That's you. We had to have an intensive driving course, because we suddenly had a lot of motorised transport, and signal platoon had five motorbikes, dispatch riders and the signal sergeant. Over this time, then I was promoted to Lance Corporal, and within a year I was Lance Sergeant.
What was your attitude towards being promoted?
I didn't want promotion, first of all. When I went into the army, I said, the general attitude was that it was going to be over in a year or 18 months, and I thought, I don't want to take any responsibility. I want to enjoy it as much as I can. And so I had turned down promotion earlier. But I was persuaded to take promotion, and I was glad I did. We then got to the time, the end of 43 and early 44, when we were posted down to Hythe in Kent, in a barracks there, and that was our final training, ready to go to Normandy.
Before we take it any further, can you tell me what the atmosphere and morale was like in England during the war?
Generally very good. You always had the one or two individuals who were anti everything, and indeed, we did have one. We had a commander posted to us about 6 months before we went abroad, who was a real bullshitter. He imported two lorry loads of cardboard and really went to town on discipline.
Cardboard?
Cardboard. Oh, those were to pack your blankets, and everything had to be absolutely spot on. And that caused problems, because he was too pernickety. One chap came back from leave and got back at 6 o'clock at night, and there was a big inspection the next morning. And he didn't feel he could get his kit up to standard for then, and he shot himself in the barrack room. So that was an indication of the morale. There was an anti-feeling.
He shot himself dead?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did you know him?
Not well, no. I mean, a battalion is, 900 people. I knew him by sight, but I didn't. He was in one of the rifle companies, so I didn't know him personally.
You mean he shot himself simply because he was too conscientious?
He knew he'd be in trouble the next day because his kit wasn't up to standard. He was one of these types who don't have much confidence in themselves, and he had been checked for not being properly prepared in the past, and I suppose he'd been home with his family for a week on leave and came back and couldn't face it. But apart from that, morale was very good. I think we had a lot of benefit from being together as a unit for all that time.
Did you and your comrades feel confident about the outcome of the war?
Yes, I don't think anyone ever felt that we were going to lose it. There were times when we said, when the hell are we going to get on with it? Because from 1940, after BEF, then things were flat. But as we became a better unit, a stronger unit, we were confident in our own ability, and we wanted to get on with it. That was the general view. Let's get on it. We've got a job to do. Let's get it over and let's get back home. So morale was really very good.
Did transfer to 43, Dave, make much difference?
Yes, because we lost a lot of our personal transport. I mean, with 4-3 Div, we'd got our own troop carriers, and sorry, with the Guards Armoured Division, we had our own troop carriers, so if we were going to move, we could move quite independently. Whereas an infantry battalion doesn't have any, it's always got to depend on other people to move at any distance. So that was the big thing, and we felt a bit downgraded. But we settled in very well. And so I suppose the only other thing that stands out about that is that early in 44 we were issued with all new vehicles. And I had a motorbike at the time. Issued with a new, I had an aerial, which I liked, but then I was issued with a Norton, and we had to run those in. We had to get 500 miles on the clock very quickly, so we had a nice week swanning around Kent with myself and the four dispatch riders to get them run in. But in the event, I found that when we got to Normandy, it was a lot of cross-country. You went off and travelling on the road. You were across fields and tracks, and the Norton was a bit high-geared. And so when one of my dispatch riders wrote off his bike, I requisitioned an aerial, and they had my Norton. So then we came to embarkation. We were due originally to go at D plus 12 or D plus 10, something like that. There were heavy storms in the channel and nothing went over for about 6 days. We were the first over after that. But we loaded up in New Haven on the SS Canterbury. And there were two battalions aboard the Canterbury. Very cramped. We had to leave an area to get some exercise in, and we, you know, had rotors in order to do it. Indeed, we were aboard that for about 48 hours before we moved out. And
Jim Norton, Reel 2.
We eventually sailed from New Haven up into Portsmouth, the strait, the Isle of Wight, strait between the Isle of Wight and the mainland, we described as being like Piccadilly Circus. I would say there were hundreds of ships and boats there, and we said, oh God, if an aircraft comes over here, he will have a time. However, there were no aircraft, and we sat there for 12 hours or more and finally sailed on the 21st, I think it was. And we sailed over to Normandy, and we were, the Canterbury was the leading ship in a group of five, because they went, we went over in groups. And we anchored offshore, and then had to dismount onto a salt landing craft, get down the side on the ropes and get into a salt landing craft.
Was that easy?
Pardon?
Was it easy?
We trained. It isn't easy, because nothing's stable. But no, there weren't any problems. And I was very fortunate, because the Mulberry Harbour, which was where we were landing, had been smashed up in the gales, but there were still parts of it intact. And the assault landing craft that I was on pulled into a piece of this, and I stepped out of the boat straight onto the Mulberry Harbour, and I didn't get my feet wet.